Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here joining us again this week. We're actually recording this right before Christmas, although you'll probably be getting this just after Christmas, a week or so later. But we want to hope that you all had a safe and healthy holiday and welcoming a new year safely as well. And we want to have you with us for the 2016 season of Disaster Podcast, so stay with us. In the meantime, though, we need to bring in our other esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley. She's in the process of getting ready to make a big move, and we'll let her tell you about that. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. Yeah, there's a lot going on. Words you never thought you'd hear from me are, it's too damn wet in California. I think we have actually starting to see the beginning of the El Nino. It rained like crazy yesterday, and it's pretty much going to be off and on, mostly on, this whole week. So it's going to be a really fun time to move, and it's supposed to be even worse as we go into January, which, of course, is where I'm going to be pulling the plug on California and going to Colorado. So I'm trading rain for snow, which should be interesting. I'll let you know as the journey progresses. And we have our friend Kevin Ryder with us tonight. We conned him into coming back on the show, and we can see what's going on up with him. And we have a really interesting guest that we're going to get to that Jamie told me about, and I can't wait to hear from him. But anything in the news, Jamie?
Well, there's a lot in the news, and Kevin and BJ, feel free to chime in. One of the things that leapt out to me that happened this week was the woman in Las Vegas that ran up onto the sidewalk and ran down 30-some people, killing one and causing major injuries to several others, and mild injuries to about 20 or so more. Just some bizarre things that have happened in 2015, and lots of mass casualty, disaster-type incidents for us to talk about. Almost too many, you think about it. And we think we're going to run out of things to talk about here on the show, and then something like this comes up.
Every week it's something. No, we never run out of things like this. And it seems like these MCI, intentional MCIs with vehicles, are becoming more common. And it's like I said earlier, why? I do not get it. I don't know what would go through somebody's mind, regardless of what's going on there in their life or road rage or general angst or what it is, that they feel okay with taking out masses of people and big people and little people, and they don't care what kind of damage they do. I do not understand. I wish someone could explain that to me.
Well, I think it has to do with just, I can't explain it, but I can only say that as a responder, it underlines the need for us to be just that much more prepared. And I know Kevin and BJ have had a lot of experience themselves. Kevin, your thoughts on just generally staying better trained, because that seems to be the only thing we can do is to be more prepared for something like this.
Exactly. I always like to read at least 2 hours a day and learn at least something, and not always in my field exactly. Sometimes having knowledge in other aspects gives me a better perspective, a better viewpoint, or it gets me to ask other questions that helps me learn, because learning is good. I try to learn at least one new thing every day. And it's out there. It's not hard to get.
It's a good plan. Oh, yeah, the references out there are amazing. But, you know, I've done critical incident stress management my whole career. And how do you sit with a group of firefighters or EMS people who, you know, when stuff happens, we all know that. The plane goes down, the fire occurs, you have the MCI. But when things are intentional, it's a lot harder to deal with, because the question of why is always out there. And clearly, we're not going to answer it. But, BJ, we're going to, at some point, have that discussion with you in more depth, because you seem to have engaged in several of those, which we'll get to later. But any thoughts on this?
I guess the first thought is, as a first responder, one of the things that I always think of is you talk about doing, incident review with everybody and doing, like, a debrief. And I actually think it's good when everybody in the room says, I don't understand how that could happen. That almost says that our mindset is totally different than the people who caused the incidents. We can't even fathom how someone would think to do that. And that's good on our part, because our constant focus, just like what we were talking about, is we're constantly training to make those positive improvements, those little bitty things that can shave seconds off our response time, anything we can do to make the improvements. And that's where our focus is. So it's kind of hard to get into the mindset of the people who do this.
Oh, absolutely. And if you notice a little accent there, you might recognize that as New Orleans.
Is that New Orleans, Jay, or is that New York? Because it sounds
Sounds New Orleans to me, or maybe
that's all New Orleans with Rue at the bottom.
Is it?
Yeah, okay, I see a little bit of both. But I'm picking up.
It's some not from New York, that's for sure.
That's true.
All right, New Jersey. But I didn't tell you, BJ, but that was kind of my second home growing up, even though I primarily lived in here in California. My dad lived in New Orleans and, in fact, worked right there in the French Quarter. So I have an affinity. But speaking of that area, we talked quite a few people about different experiences in Katrina. And BJ had one. He was right there when it all came down. And this was very different, and I think it's from a more personal perspective as a responder, which we haven't gotten too much of. And I want to start with that and take some pieces, because when we first were emailing back and forth, BJ, you sent me some little snippets from your book, which we want to talk about, that I want to refer to these specific things and some of the things you said, because I think it was completely awesome. And everybody's going to want to buy this book when we're done here.
You can say completely awesome as many times as you'd like.
No shame there. All right. But in a piece you called We Know You're All Right, I actually got a kick out of this, because we're talking 2005 here. And text messaging certainly wasn't as common as it is now. And when you have a big disaster like that, you're going to have issues with communication. So you were finding that text worked, but you'd never used it. So all of a sudden you start getting all these text messages, and basically it was saying, we know you're all right, but what about this? And what about this person? And what's going on? And you're going, well, that's a little odd. How do they know I'm all right? So when you finally, you know, after you worked for several days, you realize that, of course, there's always the TV media showing the same pieces of information and the same video over and over. And when you finally got to see it, you saw yourself in uniform loading a wounded police officer in the back of an ambulance and realized that this was the clip that was being shown over and over and over. Everybody knew you were okay because you were on the national news and you didn't even know about it.
And had no idea. The complete twist of that is, having just passed the 10th anniversary a few months ago, someone sent me that picture again as a joke. So.
Oh, no, really? I have to find that. I bet it's still out there somewhere. But, you know, you make a point about communication, which is a good one, because whenever there's a disaster, you're not going to be able to probably depend on landlines at all. We're going to depend on cell phones only to the extent that they're up and running. But it seems as though text messaging is, because it works off a different system, you might have that when everything else has failed. So that's kind of a good message there. But this is kind of trippy. I got a big kick out of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really weird. One of the things we learned is they had lost the local cell towers. So wasn't working. So we were having to go up to the highest level we could get to try to bounce it off a tower, the next parish, county for everybody else in the country, next county over. And that's where we'd get it. You couldn't make a phone call because you couldn't get enough connection, but it was enough to get those burst responses via text so that you could figure out something, get some sort of communication going.
Well, I'm going to back up here a little bit, because I didn't ask you to tell us about yourself so much. You're a cop and a medic, and it seems as though when Katrina hit you, you were in both of those roles. Tell us a little about your background.
I was in the Army in the 80s. So when I got out of the Army, I did both medical and I was a helicopter crew chief. And when I got out, I got into law enforcement initially. I spent time as both a policeman and was recruited into a rescue division that the police department had at the time, where I got my first medic training, official National Registry training, and fell in love with it. Definitely something that I always wanted to be part of. So as I moved along, I became a paramedic, worked with the city of New Orleans for years, had several opportunities, and went back into doing kind of a dual role, doing law enforcement as a tactical team leader, also working as a tactical medic and instructor. So pretty much I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up, so I've had the opportunity to jump around.
Well, I can see where when you're in a disaster situation like this, both roles are going to have to apply. You're never going to be, well, I'm just going to be the medic today and not the cop, because as a statement you made in here was about the fact that the thugs and miscreants, however you pronounce it, had no problem realizing the world had temporarily stopped rotating. And of course, as we know, security was a big issue, and that's part of what you were doing. But as the story goes, you were talking about a fire that broke out, and you envisioned yourself watching that. And I just want to read this little piece here. We topped the Crescent City Connection Bridge over the Mississippi River, and off in the distance was one firelight at the fire we were headed to. It was the only point bright enough to identify, an eerie orange and yellow beacon in the darkness of a city that we were unsure was going to survive the next few days. We slowed as we looked, and the only thought that clearly resonated with me was that the fire was like a message. It would be the only thing visible for miles, and much like a moth to the flame, this fire would draw all the people that were happy with the fall of the city. The wolves, the hyenas, the mentally imbalanced would all be drawn to it, looking to be dazzled by the lights and feed on its energy. It was more in that moment that I understood. I knew then that this was more of a fight. This was more than a fight for a few miles of flooded real estate. It was a battle for the soul of a people, a guerrilla war to save the cultural heart of the city I loved. In the end, we lost a few of the battles, but I think we won the war. I just got chills again. I got chills the first time I read that, and I got chills right now. That is so profound.
Thank you.
Because I just don't know how to respond to that, because you're seeing the ugliness that comes with a disaster and those people that would do things despite the disaster, but you know, you know that, and it's a battle. It's a battle for the soul of a people. This, and especially this incident that was so huge and covered so much area and involved so many people. You know, you had to have some faith that you were going to get through this. Talk to us about that incident a bit.
Yeah, emotionally. We all know we compartmentalize whenever we do our job, but it's normally for these brief periods of time with trauma where or you put that to side so that you can deal with it later. This went on for days into weeks, and it was just the more you saw, the more fear and worry you had going on inside you that made it so difficult. I mean, this particular incident, it was one of those things. We all have that moment when things just click and you kind of realize this is real. This is very serious. And it's not that I didn't realize it was serious at that point, but here it is the middle of the night and firemen, medic, policemen are all trying to do the job that they were trained to do, which is not the job we were doing. Here we were very much trying to resurrect a third world nation that happened overnight. I joke all the time that if Waterworld was real, the movie, it would have been New Orleans. It was it was so amazing to see this situation and realize we are not prepared for this, but we have to do everything we can, because if we don't, it could easily turn into the last gasping breath for the city.
Oh, my God. And, you know, Joe Hawley, who's usually with us, he's crazy busy this week, needless to say, he's a DMAT doc, and I'm a DMAT medic. So we go into an area, but are able to maintain some neutrality, because these aren't, we create relationships with people, but we don't get too emotionally involved. Taking what you were just saying a step further, your family is there. You went to your parents' house and your sister's house and you saw the damage, and you may not even know where they were for a while. And so when you go in this home and find your niece's room, as you put it, slime on the carpet, mold growing on stuffed animals and toys, and knowing that all of that was lost, I want to give you this last piece here, and Kevin hasn't heard any of this yet. I had witnessed death, depravity, and a general decline in humanity over the weeks, but had stayed strong and positive. The sight of their toys ruined and forever taken from them was my emotional tipping point. A lump formed in my throat as I rushed out the house, but I couldn't stop the tears from coming. I cried for the things they lost. I cried for the change that was thrust on them and all of us. I cried for that piece of innocence that they would lose because of this tragedy. I cried for my unborn son and the different world he would call normal. I cried for myself because all I wanted to do was protect my family, and I was unsure if I would be able to in this new reality. I got chills again, BJ. This really shows you, and I'm so glad that you captured this and you wrote it down, because not everybody can do that. And I hope that it was all of this, writing this down was cathartic for you, because I personally think it works for me. This is a great way to kind of do a dump of how you're feeling. And to me, it's a very positive thing, and I hope it was for you too. Obviously, you were in a real hard place right there because you're witnessing all of this for the first time and projecting on how it's going to affect the future, how it's going to affect your family in the future. It was just mind-blowing. And I wish you said something early about, you know, EMSers being in these kinds of things, and we know not everybody deals with it as well as they should. They kind of still want to keep it inside. This says something very positive in we need to deal with this. We need to get it out. We need to cry once in a while. You know, maybe we can't do it when you're in the middle of it, but you got to do it eventually. Will you speak to that?
I definitely think that's, as we went through this in the initial days that it happened, you're with that core group of people you work with, who you lean on them, they lean on you, and you're doing a job and you focus on the job. I knew my family was out of town, but I had gotten my wife out after a few days. I knew everybody was as safe as they could be. So I was able to try to put all that out of my mind at the time and just focus on the job. I think that whole situation, going and seeing the houses, it really brought the thought process back where I had to start looking ahead again. It was no longer living in that moment. It was having to look ahead and realizing how difficult and hard things were going to be. It's very weird, and I'm sure you've seen it in different communities, but New Orleans has a new time scale. It's much like when you think about before or after a point, such as the bombing of Pearl Harbor. New Orleans, everything is rated as before or after Katrina, period.
When you
talk about anything that's happened in the last 15 years, it is rated as before or after. That's the only way to draw a timeline for it. And you talk about being cathartic to write. I can say that I talked to Jim. Jim and I had talked about this, that when I started writing the book, it had no intention of being a book. It had the intention of being a collection of short stories, funny stories that I've told 1,000 times, you know, and my family urged me to write them down. And I found that as the funny stories came out, there were a bunch of other stories that I felt really needed to be written. And I put them off, and I tried to put them off a little more. And then when I started writing them, they really brought up the emotion of the moment. And it actually helped so much to be able to get it out there on paper, because my thought was much like you said. If one person reads the stories and says, it's okay to feel that way, or, boy, there's somebody else who's been through something similar than I have, then I've been a success. And that's all I can hope for.
Kevin, I was wondering if Kevin had any thoughts.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
This has been the stuff you read, Sam. Again, you said you got chills. I did too. I'm wondering, you know, Kevin, what your thoughts are, because you have dealt with, you know, you were around when Sandy hit the East Coast.
Mm-hmm, correct. Yeah. I didn't even give a thought to capturing the moments or anything. I was going to focus on making sure everyone was okay, you know, trying to deal with the damage that had been done. And then we got activated to do help, you know, in the city. So my mind wasn't really even thinking about that. But it's awesome you were able to either go back and write those feelings down or capture that moment, so to speak. I've never thought about doing that. But yeah, that was awesome, dude.
Well, we all have different ways of diffusing ourselves, and Kevin, that may not be your way. Jamie and I are both writers, and obviously BJ, so that works for him. You may have other ways of doing it.
Well, technically I'm a writer, but...
Well, a different kind of writer. Just the fact that that's your last name and it's spelled funny is a different thing. So, Jamie, I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, I just, you know, like you said in the very beginning, for anybody that's listening to this show, we've had a lot of responders on talking about Katrina, but the one thing that differentiates their stories from BJ's stories is they were all visitors. They were all responders who came in 3, 4, 5 days, a week or so, 2 weeks later with federal resources teams, or responders coming from non-governmental organizations, or other areas of responders around the country who cycled units down there to help support the area. And so it wasn't home to them. And so the difference that I see here, and maybe that's why it's so poignant, is that BJ, you this is home to you. And so
you couldn't
sit there and say, well, I can go, you know, I'm only here for a week, I'll be back home. You know, you were home.
To accentuate on that, this is what happened on day 2 and 3. I would work from sun up to sundown. So we'd do about 14 hours, 15 hours working. Then I would go home. They had a place for us to stay. They had a tent that we could stay in at first. And then we actually moved. We lived in a nursing home for a while, which was a unique and interesting thing for a medic. But for the first couple of days, I would go home to my house at night, start my generator and put up a light set so that I could strip carpet out of my house and cut sheetrock to do everything I could to try to keep. We kept seeing that this was going to be a long, drawn-out thing. So I wanted to try as quick as possible to make my house not a mold festival, as so many became. So you'd work all day, and then you'd go home and have to do that and stand in the yard with the garden hose to take your shower and then get back in a uniform and go back to work. It was you knew you were working in your own hometown. There was no doubt about that.
Oh, that's miserable. Well, lastly, BJ, tell us about, I'm not going to read an excerpt from this, but I enjoyed the story about Raymond. Tell us about Raymond and how you interacted with him.
First, I have to say, Raymond, who is in many of my stories in the book, a dear friend, just passed away less than a month
ago. Oh, that's so sad.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Great guy. If you read any of the stories with him, you know he definitely lived it up to levels that most of us will never be able to reach. But Raymond was at the main EMS station, which is along Bayou St. John in New Orleans. And that area started to flood, and he was there with the crews and his dog. So they moved down to where Delgado Community College is. It has a multi-story building, and the water started coming up there. And they were going to have to evacuate from there again. There was no place left to go in the city. And they told Raymond they wouldn't take his dog, and he opted for not going with them. Him and his dog were going to swim off and go back to where they were at the original EMS station. And all the medics ended up across the river on the west bank of the Mississippi River at this nursing home. And one of the medics had come up to me, one of the guys that I had FTO'd over the years, and he said, look, I just ran across somebody when we were out in the city, and they said they saw Raymond. Or they saw somebody who looked like Raymond. They saw this guy with his dog. Can you get a group of people together so that we can go and see if we can get him and bring him back here? Of course, let's go do it. So I grab one of my guys from the TAC team, and we get a boat and some guys, and we head out to go get them. Long story short is we find him. I don't think he really needed rescuing when we found him. He found two young gypsy girls that obviously needed a little help. So between him, his dog, and a case of MREs, they had made them a safe haven. And all he wanted from me was my skull when we found him. He said he wasn't ready to be rescued yet. We could come back in a few days.
Well, and I don't know that you mentioned that he was almost rescued the first time, but they wouldn't take the dog, so he declined.
Yeah, he declined. He wouldn't
swim. Swam.
Yeah, he would not go anywhere without Nico, his dog.
I would be right.
It's interesting because we've changed the approach to disaster response to include pets.
Yeah.
Because we found out during Katrina and other events that people wouldn't leave their pets behind, and we couldn't get people to evacuate if we couldn't assure them that their shelter they were headed to would allow them to bring their pet with them.
I agree. I was one of those people. I mean, for the storm itself on that Sunday night into that early Monday morning, I stayed at one of the major hospitals. My wife was a hospital administrator at the time. They had set up at the hospital for us to bring our pets to the hospital and converted an area for them. So we had brought our dogs. I actually drove out of the hospital parking garage at like 8 o'clock on a Monday morning with dry streets heading home, saying, I'm going home to get in uniform, going to work. I took the dogs home. Little did I know that the levees were breaking at that point, and within hours, 8 foot of water was right back in that area where we were. The horrible side of that is no one had thought of what would happen for prolonged periods of time. And they ended up having to euthanize a lot of the pets because they were succumbing to the heat and lack of food. They didn't have enough food for the humans. So it was very tragic.
Wow, I can't even imagine that. Yeah, it is huge. You're right, Jamie. And I remember some of the comments coming out of our team because they were largely involved in evacuating people from the airport, getting them up from the internal side of the airport up onto the roof so they could be helicoptered out. And they say they saw that in the field all the time, that people would not leave without their pets. And I'm afraid I'd be one of them. But, you know, what was that like, BJ? Because you think, okay, the hurricane's gone through, we're good to go. You're starting to think we're going to take care of some things and then go into a recovery mode. And then suddenly those levees break, which was huge for us. I mean, we had teams at the Superdome, had all their equipment and trucks and everything on the lower level, and we lost a lot of equipment because nobody expected that to happen. What was your take on that?
Well, you look back at it, and it's hard to even fathom. From the moment, it's one of those things where you have no information. We were so confused. I've weathered many a hurricane here in New Orleans, and I remember walking out of the hospital telling my wife, I'll probably see you tomorrow. They'll keep you through tonight since you're running the department, and then we'll both be off tomorrow. She's like, yeah, that's what we expected. No one had any idea what was going on and what was happening. Even when the water started coming up, it was just confusion. No one had any idea how or what was going on. For us, it was days because there was no communication, and what we were getting was very, very thin. I guess I got my first true confirmation about 5 days in. I took a helicopter tour over the city to try to spot some areas out, and that's when we saw some of the first levee breaks and really realized what we were dealing with.
Oh my God! So, what'd you end up doing? Taking your dogs back to the hospital?
I brought my dog. I lived on the West Bank. I was very, very lucky in the fact that I lived on the West Bank of the river. My house got about 2 foot of water in it, and then the water immediately went down. So it was able to be lived in, unlike the rest of the city that weeks later still had 6-8 feet of water. I have pictures from my sister's house where she had 14 feet of water in her living room.
Oh. That pretty much ruins everything, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. So we'll probably be winding up this piece here. What kind of advice would you give responders, both those that are like, I imagine there's a whole lot of confusion when you're in the area responding to a disaster in the area you live with. And the first and most important piece being, how are people going to react to the dichotomy of I got to work, but yet I got to take care of my family. And then just those days and days and days of being dealt, it's not like you can leave. So that's one piece of it. But as a first responder to that, what kind of advice would you give people either there or coming in to help?
That's a great way to put the question, because we learned a lot of things. And I mean, as people along the Gulf Coast, you always hear us talk about, you know, you have to have a plan for hurricanes. And as first responders, I think it's paramount that you have a plan for your family. because you were probably going to be called to task for small or large emergencies. And the last thing you want to do is be worrying about your loved ones. You want to make sure that they're somewhere safe. Take all the contingencies and have multiple plans. Say, okay, this is what I planned, but if this doesn't work, have your fallback plan. So have everything laid out for your family. As an agency, we learn so many things. It's nothing like learning from your own mistakes. And we truly looked at things and said, how could we have gotten this so wrong? How could we have thought through this and not gotten any of these clues down? And it was just, no one would have ever, if you'd have said beforehand, okay, we're gonna do a little tabletop mass cow. Let's talk about the city flooding with 10 foot of water over the entire city. You'd have laughed them off the table. You'd have said, we can't. That's ridiculous. But we learned that it wasn't. So being able to be open-minded enough to look at all the possible contingencies and having all the plans that you can possibly lay down.
Kevin, what are your thoughts on that?
I totally agree. What I try and teach and will be soon writing about, don't fall into the narrow focus of planning for one thing. You can't, this isn't, you know, a TV show where you're planning for just the EMP or just this. You have to consider anything and everything. And like BJ just said, have multiple backups, because the situation may dictate this backup plan is not feasible. We need to go to step two or backup plan B. And if that somehow fails, you have to have a backup for that. And that's, I couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. And on that note, since we're talking about training and the impossibility of training for something no one could ever foresee, BJ, if you were in charge of the world in terms of EMS and public safety training, what would you focus on now that you wouldn't have thought of focusing on pre-Katrina?
Logistics.
Ah.
So important. And for what we do in EMS, for what we do as first responders in general, we're normally fairly short-sighted for the length of a dilemma. We look in terms of hours, maybe days, with very little planning into weeks, potentially months. And the logistics of making sure that you can do things as simple as feed your people, you know, housing, food, fuel, the things that you can't operate without, unless you're back in the Stone Ages or doing straight up wilderness medicine, you have to have all these things. And there was so many things we had to learn on the fly because there was no plan, true plan for long-term handling of it. EMP is a great example that, you know, something like that is a long-term event that, if you don't have some sort of plan, just like having lost the electricity for so long in New Orleans, you have to kind of make things up as you go. How do you charge batteries for your monitors? How do you handle your radio system? There was one entire day in New Orleans that every police agency in a 50-mile radius was on the one channel. They were all on, was that 176.5? Everybody.
Oh my.
10,000 people on one channel. As you can imagine, not a lot of communicating happened that day.
Oh, I can only imagine. I just wish Jim and Joe were here, Jamie, because this is great stuff that I'm sure a lot's changed. BJ, I would guess that, we hope to hell we ever see an event this size again, but I'm sure a lot of those things are taken into consideration, because you're talking police departments, hospitals, ambulance companies. In order to stay in business, you have, like you said, you got to have the basic needs met for those people, and that's the least of it.
Right. State of Louisiana has done something pretty tricky with their medical supplies as far as emergency response. Instead of storing them in one place, they have volunteers as part of the state response that we have trailers filled with the medical supplies stationed all over the state. So Perfect. if if an area decides it has to evacuate, you don't lose those supplies. Somebody just hooks them up to a Sprint vehicle or a unit and takes them somewhere else so that they can be easily moved from location to location for any emergency that occurs.
Yeah, and it's we've little done
things
that in
like
California
that can make too, all the difference.
It does, and that's a decision we made in California, mostly because I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we can easily be get cut off, you know, from the north and south. There's a lot of strange geographical contingencies in California, but that's the same.
I remember the 89 quake very well.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Well, I'll talk about that later. Yes, we did. I don't know, Jamie, what do you think? Are you guys
think
Baltimore?
Well, you know,
big one?
You know, We dodged a bullet with Sandy. It went north of us and hit New Jersey and New York. But I'm in the northeastern part of Maryland on the top of the Chesapeake Bay. And we were worried it was going to hit Maryland and Delaware. And it just went just a little north of us. It's not beyond the realm of our imagination that we could all, no matter where we are, be struck with a major event like this, and we all should be prepared for it. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have, you know, the training resources that we have, and we are thankful for our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, with Joe and Jim and the gang. And yeah, they're going to really like listening to this episode, I think, and work some of these things into their training. But folks should definitely check them out. Thank them for supporting the fact that we can bring you this show and bring you the conversations with Kevin and BJ and Sam and myself this week. I would just say, you know, head over to paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can look them up at paragonmededu on Twitter. We'll have links to everything in the show notes. And we want to definitely make sure that you head over there and just drop them a note and say thanks for bringing the Disaster Podcast to you for the last 2 years and into the next year. Kevin, tell us a little bit about where we can find you. I know you do a lot of wilderness training and general safety training as well. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself and where they can find you.
Well, you can find me on the web at wildsafety.com. You can email me at training@wildsafety.com. I'm on Twitter @wildsafety. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Everything is linked. A little bit about me, a 30-second blurb. I teach wilderness medicine, diving medicine, urban preparedness, and a whole bunch of other stuff. I have lots of experience in different areas. You can go read my quick bio on the website. I won't bore you with that here, but yeah. And I'm usually with Sam or Jamie at a conference.
Definitely. And we appreciate you coming on and filling in tonight. We wanted to have somebody else on the show and get a different perspective and a different point of view from somebody else that's involved in this kind of preparedness, resource training and things. And so, Kevin, thanks for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jamie. Appreciate it.
BJ, tell folks where they can find this book, Welcome to New Orleans. How many shots did you hear? It's a great title and a great read. And where can folks find out more about it and where can they get a copy?
You can go to my website at howmanyshotsdidyouhear.com. It's available at Amazon for Nook, and it is also at Smashwords. And the print version should be available in the next week on Amazon.
Awesome.
Excellent. I'll have links in the show notes for that. So if it's going to be out in the next week, I should be able to, while this episode comes out, it actually will be, should be available. And if it is, I'll make sure we have links to all of that in the show notes so you can get a copy for yourself. And BJ, thanks for sharing your experiences with what happened in Katrina. And I know it's deeply personal for you, and it's important for us to share those experiences with others. So thank you so much for doing that.
Anytime. I feel it's very important for me to share my experiences. Hopefully somebody learns from some of the mistakes we've made or maybe learns a few things from a couple of things we got right. That's all we can ask.
Great. Hey, Sam, where can we find you?
in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. And Jamie, aren't we going to be going to New Orleans next fall?
We will be in New Orleans next fall for EMS World Expo 2016. It's returning to New Orleans again. And it's a great town. My wife and I actually honeymooned there 25 odd years ago. So I always enjoy going back to New Orleans, and she might even be coming with me this time.
That'd be great.
Yeah. So we'll see if that works out. It depends on her work schedule and things. But, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, if we're down there, you know, if you're around, we'd love to have you come hang out with us a little bit and chat with us, BJ.
Would love to. I plan on being at the convention myself.
Excellent. Well, folks, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places online and social media. So please look me up and friend me or follow me in wherever you find me. And you can always find me here at the Disaster Podcast at disasterpodcast.com. Leave a comment on the show notes if you have a question for BJ. You can definitely do that. We'll make sure he gets the message and he can come back and leave a comment and we'll comment back as well. And let's have a little discussion about what you heard about. What would you do in this situation if a major event happened that just devastated your community for an extended period of time? How would you be able to respond and continue to do your job in the midst of all of that? So it's something for all of us to think about. And again, kudos to you, BJ, for doing that, and you and your colleagues. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Sam, you know, we've heard a lot about, you know, how BJ handled dealing with this type of disaster preparedness and disaster EMS. And it just keeps underlining our catchphrase for the show every single week. We just keep coming back to it.
It does. And I don't think we've had a better example of the fact that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.